Looking at our world from a theological perspective. This is the Theology Central Podcast, making theology central.
Good evening, everyone. It is Sunday, August the 1st, 2021. It is currently 6:01 p.m. Central Time, and I'm coming to you live from the Sanctuary of Victory Baptist Church, located right here in the middle of nowhere, Texas. It is 6 p.m., so what I would prefer right now is to be standing behind the pulpit and people actually sitting here in the pews. But, well, that is not the situation. If you heard the last live broadcast and you know what happened this morning, the power went off. And so I was afraid. The power went off right in the middle of my sermon and everyone had to leave. The power never came back on. So ultimately, I went home and told everyone, hey, just don't bother about coming back because I'm not going to know if the power is on or not on because I live, you know, I'd have to have someone try to come up here and check. And it was just going to be, then I was going to have to try to contact everyone going, no, don't come back. Or, you know, it was, I had to just make the decision right there on the spot. So since I didn't really know what was going on, the power didn't come back on. We made the decision not to have an in-person service. I thought about just staying home and not even bothering to come back. But then I was like, you know what? I'll go back, record a quick message, letting everyone know what happened this morning. And then make sure that everything in the church is okay. Well, I came back. The power was on. Yes, there were lights that had been left on. All of the sound equipment, that had all been left on. So it was good that I came back and turned everything off and made sure everything was okay. And once I realized the power was on, I was like, well, I'm here. I'm here. Yeah. My voice isn't. My voice decided to take a vacation. And the power just went off on my voice. Okay. What happened right there? My voice just almost completely just gave up. I was like, well, I'm here at the church. So let's turn on the microphone and let's do something. Let's try to make sure that I provide people some spiritual food, some spiritual nourishment. So if you're listening live, welcome. You can participate at any time by hitting the little chat icon there on the Spreaker app. You can say hello, ask questions, ask for clarification, because this is a Bible study exercise and I'm going to be giving you, oh, you know what? I'm going to be giving you some homework, right? It's not even really homework in a Bible study exercise. It's just work, right? It's not really homework because it's not like extra. It's just homework is always like you go to school all day, then you get your homework, which is almost extra. This is just your work. It's your in-class work, right? So the Bible study exercises for those who are new, very simple. They are designed with one very specific goal in mind, to move you from being a passive listener to an active participant. How I do that is I do the Bible study exercise where I do some of the teaching and then some I leave for you. I give you specific assignments. The goal is for you to do those assignments, then send them to me at newsif@yahoo.com. I look at what you have done, and then I take what you've done, and then I come back here, turn on the microphone, and then we add to our study with what you have studied, what you found, what you discovered. In many cases, that helps me, that challenges me. And it's supposed to be like this big group of people studying the Bible and working together to try to discover truth and try to find what the text is actually saying by utilizing good Bible study skills and good hermeneutical skills. That's what it's designed to do. I can't really tell you how many people who actively participate. I don't know the number. There are those who do the work, send it to me. The majority of people do not, but I'm hoping that the majority of people who do not send me their work have notebooks somewhere and they're working on it and they're doing that. I know at one point someone contacted me and they were inviting a friend over and they were going to like binge listen to all of the Bible study exercises. That was very encouraging. So sometimes I don't know what's going on. Like I can't see beyond this microphone, right? So I don't really know what's going on the other side. Sometimes it's interesting, right? Sometimes you just kind of give up and like, you know what? No one's doing anything. No one's paying attention. No one's listening. No one cares. And so you're like, okay, that's it. You just stop. And then all of a sudden everyone starts contacting you. You go, wait, what's going on? Wait, where did you go? Why did you stop recording? Wait, why did you stop broadcasting? What happened? Sometimes you think no one's listening. And then you find out that people are listening. So it's always hard to interpret silence, but I'm hoping that the Bible study exercises are proving to be beneficial. And currently, we're in Psalm 37, and this is what part, in fact, let me open the app really quick. I don't even remember currently. Part 15, yes, this is Psalm 37, part 15. 15 different Bible study exercises and the chapter of in the book of Psalms, Psalm 37. Yes, that's the chapter we've been looking at. 15 studies. Hopefully they've been challenging. Hopefully they've been beneficial. I've done some teaching and I've given you a lot to do. And hopefully those assignments have proven to really help you. Hopefully you understand Psalm 37 better than you ever understood it before you started studying it. And I really do hope that that is the case. I'm embarrassed right now how bad I just said all of that, right? And so 37 parts in Psalm part 30, part 15 and so I was just having all kinds of problems saying that correctly. Now I'm embarrassed and I just want to start over. But there's no starting over in a live broadcast. So there we have it. We have done, this is part 15 in our study of Psalm 37. 15 Bible study exercises, or 14 have been done. And when we're done here, this will be the 15th. And again, hopefully that's all great for you. Now, the last one was kind of, I was listening to the last one on the way to church this morning. And I wasn't super happy with it. The goal of the last one was very simple, right? Because I found, I got a magazine in my mailbox that had an article about five observations of Psalm 37. And I'm like, okay, that I'll just use that like someone sent it to me. And then we'll look at their observations and kind of help, you know, give us more insight into the chapter. It didn't come off as great as I wanted it to, but hopefully it proved to be beneficial. Now, this one tonight, this one's going to be very important, all right? Now, I think all of them are important, but this one is super important because we're going to be dealing with a very important subject that some people may feel is very controversial, and it may really challenge how you've handled the Bible before, all right? Here's what we're going to do, all right? We're going to be looking at Psalm 37. We're going to be looking really at least at one small section. What we're going to do is we're going to start pretty much, let me see, where are we at? About the middle of Psalm 37. And I'm going to have you go from about the middle of Psalm 37 to the end of Psalm 37. And I'm going to have you be looking, I'm going to have you look for something very, very, very specific. And then I'm going to have you struggle with how to understand it and how to interpret it, right? And let me help you understand what we're going to be looking for. In the Bible, we all know this, there are promises, right? The Bible is filled with promises. Sometimes those promises refer to what God may do for us in eternity. It may be a promise that deals with eternity. There are some promises that may be dealing with your life here on earth, right? So let's think of it this way. When we think of promises in the Bible, we have some promises that are, let's say, are focused on eternity. It's not focused on the here and now, it's focused on eternity, all right? We could argue some so we'll just say eternal. We have some promises that deal with what's going to happen here on earth, maybe in your lifetime, maybe at a future time, but they're earthly promises. So we have heavenly promises and earthly promises, all right? That's very important. You've got to know the difference, right? If it's giving you a promise about something that's going to happen in heaven, I can't take that heavenly promise and say, oh no, it's going to happen right here on earth. Because, well, then it's not going to happen that way, and then it's going to lead to disappointment and frustration. So we got to draw a distinction between heavenly and earthly, right? Another thing when it comes to Bible promises, you have Bible promises. Some of them are conditional promises. In other words, here's the promise, and you get the promise if you meet the condition. For example, there are promises in the Bible that talks about being blessed. Blessed is the man. And then it will tell you, blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the ungodly, stand, sit, who meditates on God's word day and night. It gives you kind of like, if you want to be blessed, this particular blessing that's being spoken of, there are conditions. There are some promises that are conditional. So you've got to identify the promise and identify what the conditions are, right? For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whosoever believeth in him shall not perish, but have everlasting life. There's a promise of never perishing and having everlasting life. But the condition is I must believe in, obviously, Jesus Christ. I must believe in the son that was sent by the Father. Okay. So there is a promise there, but it's conditional. So whenever you find a promise, you got to determine, is it heavenly? Is it earthly? You got to determine if it's conditional. Okay. And there may be some promises that are unconditional. All right. For God so loved the world, there is a promise of God's love and it's unconditional. Now we could argue, is there different types of love that God may have? But for God so loved the world, there are some promises, and that's not maybe the best one, but I just want you to get the idea. Some promises are just unconditional. This is just the way it works. This is just the way it is. It's unconditional. I don't think there's many unconditional ones, but there are unconditional. So there's conditional and unconditional. And then there are promises that we're going to put in the category are not applicable. They have nothing to do for, they're not to you. They're not about you. You can't claim it. You can't name it. You can't do anything with it. It's not applicable. It's not for you. I've told the story before. Let me tell it to you again. When I was a young Christian, I worked at Texas Instruments, right? Texas Instruments. Was this in Texas Instruments? It may have been at Texas Instruments. I can't remember exactly where I was working at them. It may have been in the military. I can't remember exactly where I was, but because it happened a long time ago. But there was this woman who had, her and her husband wanted to have a baby. And they've been struggling and struggling and seeing the doctor. And, you know, they wanted to have a baby, wanted to have a baby. And at that point, she had not become pregnant. They were very frustrated, very discouraged. She was, having her morning devotions. And she was in Genesis and God. And she read where God promised Sarah a baby, that Abraham and Sarah, they were going to have a baby. Abram and Sarah. Okay, yeah, I remember their names become Abraham and Sarah. Okay, you get the idea. All right. She read those promises. And she claimed those promises for herself. And then she came basically saying that, you know, she heard from God this morning in her reading of the scripture and that she knew that she was going to have a baby because God was going to give her one because she found the promise in scripture and claimed it. And I wanted to say, is your husband's name Abraham? In fact, I actually may have even said it because sometimes I wasn't always the most tactful person. I've tried to get better at that. But I think I may have actually said, is your husband's name Abraham? Is your name Sarah? No? Okay, well, that promise has nothing to do with you. It's not applicable to you. Why are you claiming that promise? It's not for you. There are promises that are not applicable. Here's another one. You know this one. Very, 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 very famous. Jeremiah chapter 29, verse 11. For I know the thoughts that I think toward you, saith the Lord, thoughts of peace and not of evil, to give you an expected end. Now, I've heard that promise claimed in so many situations. I've heard it claimed over and over and over by Christians. It's not applicable. It's not for you. It only takes, like, I don't know, basic reading comprehension to read the chapter, and you're going to find out, wait a minute, this is for the people who were in Babylonian captivity, who's going to come back from Babylonian captivity. God knows the thoughts that he has towards you, the Lord, thoughts of peace, not of evil, to give you an expected end. He's referring to the people coming out of Babylonian captivity. Read the chapter. In fact, you can just see it, Jeremiah chapter 29, verse 1. Now, these are the words of the letter that Jeremiah the prophet sent from Jerusalem unto the residue of the elders, which were carried away captives, and to the priest, and to the prophets, and to all the people whom Nebuchadnezzar had carried away captive from Jerusalem to Babylon. It clearly identifies who it's to. It's not to you. You can't quote it during your high school graduation speech. I guess you can, but it has nothing to do with you. You can't claim this promise. So there are some promises that are not applicable. So you have some promises that are talking about something in heaven, not something on earth. It's a heavenly promise. You have some that are earthly, and then you got to determine, okay, earthly for when, okay? Some may be conditional. Some may be unconditional. And some may be completely not applicable. And I think so much of what happens within Christianity and sometimes the confusion is a mishandling of the promises of God. And these are just basic, like, this is elementary principle stuff. This is nothing deep, nothing profound. Every Christian should know this stuff. Now, what's frustrating is I say it's elementary and basic, and then I listen to sermons from pastors who went to seminary. And they stand behind the pulpit and seem to clearly and literally demonstrate a complete misunderstanding of these very basic Bible study, Bible understanding principles. If you can't get the promises right, I don't know how I can trust you with anything in the text, right? If I can't promise, if I can't trust you to get Jeremiah 29:11 right, when that's got to be one of the easiest passages to interpret with just a basic reading of context, I can't trust you to get, I don't know how I'm going to trust you in anything else. And I've heard pastor after pastor make that mistake. So what does it have to do with Psalm 37? Well, it's pretty straightforward. I want you to listen. Because this is, now this is going to be controversial, but we've got to consider this. There are times where there seems to be a promise in the Bible that seems to be very specific, very straightforward. But when you look at the promise, you're like, well, wait a minute. If that is true, then why, look, it doesn't seem to be happening here. It doesn't seem to be happening here. If that's just a definitive promise that is true for, say, anyone who's a Christian, then there's a lot of things I don't understand because there's lots of situations where that promise doesn't appear to be true. Now, whenever you find that, or doesn't appear to be occurring, let me state it that way. Like, sometimes there's these promises, and you're like, that seems to promise that I'm going to have everything I need. And then you find Christians in parts of the world where they're starving. And you're like, well, wait. And look at how many people starve to death every day in the world. Are you going to claim, like, how do we understand that? You have all kinds of other promises that people claim. And then when it doesn't happen, usually Christians will then say, well, you did something wrong because that's a promise. So you're not saved or you're not spiritual. And you're like, whoa, slow down there. All right. We have to consider, have we understood the promises correct? Are they specific promises or are they giving general principles, not necessarily trying to give us promises, or are the promises not applicable? I mean, we've got to ask some tough questions. If you think there's a promise, for example, a lot of people run around claiming that healing, physical healing, is guaranteed right here on earth right now. So they remove it from a heavenly, like ultimately when I'm in heaven, I'm going to have a new body when there's going to be no more pain, sickness, or death. So ultimately there is a guarantee for healing. There is a promise for healing, but it's heavenly. They pull it from the heavenly domain, bring it to the earthly domain, and say that God, it's his will to heal you of anything and everything that you face. All you got to do is basically have faith. So then they argue if you don't get healed, it's because you didn't meet a condition. And so then they put all of this blame, and guess what? Ultimately, everyone's going to fail because everyone's ultimately going to die. So ultimately, there's something God's not going to heal you with unless Christ returns. So there's the whole problem with that whole healing promise guarantee is it just over and over and over, it doesn't work. Over and over, people get sick. Again, I worked in the medical world for 22 years. I don't know how many charismatics claimed it, named it, and then called us for an appointment because it didn't go away. And you're like, well, where's that promise at? Where's that promise at? Are they taking medicine or a number of other things? They're like, why aren't, you don't need medicine. You don't need anything because you can be healed. You could take your car and drive it in a tree, and as long as you're still breathing, in fact, well, actually, if you die, the person in the car can just raise you from the dead. But, of course, it doesn't work that way, and I was in the military. How many people came back from war, missing arms, missing legs? I've yet to see charismatics pull off that. I've yet to see them, quote unquote. Now, they always have these stories, supposedly, but you would think there'd be videos of it everywhere. Here's a person missing an arm. It's clearly medically documented, and you prayed, and the arm just reappeared. Okay, so yeah, we could talk all day about those issues. So what happens when we come across these texts where you're like, man, that's, how do we understand? Is that a promise? Is that a general principle? What do we do? So we're in a section here in Psalm 37 where I think some of these, I'm not going to say this is a perfect example of it, but there's at least, it appears to be some promises and we need to identify all of them. What appears to come across as promises. So let me just go through and show you. All right. Okay. So we have some discussion about the wicked in Psalm 37 verse 14. The wicked have drawn out the sword and have bent their bow to cast down the poor and needy, and to slay such as be of upright conversation. Their sword shall enter into their own heart, and their bowels shall be broken. All right? Now, this ultimately is a promise for the destruction of the wicked. Now, you could ask yourself, I guess we could start right here in some ways. This is a promise that the wicked are going to be stopped. Now, is this A promise that's going to be fulfilled in eternity? Or is this some kind of promise that ultimately the wicked are going to be stopped and destroyed here on earth? Is this like every time the wicked tries to do something, they're going to be stopped? Well, we know that can't be the promise, because earlier in this chapter, it talks about the wicked and their plans being prosperous and succeeding. So this has to have some kind of a future judgment mentality, I would think. All right, but let's continue. Verse 16, Psalm 37, 16. A little that a righteous man hath is better than the riches of many wicked. All right, so far so good. For the arms of the wicked shall be broken, but the Lord upholdeth the righteous. Now let's stop right here. All right, now the arms of the wicked shall be broken. Now again, do we understand that as a promise, like that every time the wicked get ready to do something on this earth, their arms are broken? Well, you know that's not true. Wicked people do all kinds of things. They succeed in all kinds of evil schemes, plans. The wicked people murder, they hurt, they rape. All kinds of horrible things. So that has to be some kind of a future, right? Does it? I think that's the only way to understand that, all right? But there's another promise here. The Lord upholdeth the righteous. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to focus on the promises here, because I think any promise about the destruction and failure of the wicked has to be ultimately an eternal promise, a heavenly promise ultimately, because that's ultimately where the wicked will be destroyed. Now, we could try to put this in some kind of a historical setting, possibly, but it would have to be very specific, because even in the Bible, the wicked seem to prosper numerous situations. So, yeah, that has to be just a general concept that the wicked will ultimately be destroyed, and which is how we've understood all of this up to this point. But now it mentions the righteous. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at the promises that are directed towards the righteous, and we're going to move through them, and we're going to try to identify these promises. And then it's going to be up to you to figure out, well, what do we do with this? So let's look at the first one. The Lord upholdeth the righteous. What does that mean? If that's a promise that God upholds the righteous, upholds us in what way? Upholds us in a spiritual way? Upholds us in a physical way? Does he uphold us so that we can never be harmed by the wicked? Well, that clearly is not true. He upholds us in what way does he uphold us? I think this has to be a spiritual promise, understood spiritually and understood that way. I don't think you can make this necessarily an earthly kind of concept. It's a spiritual one. He upholds me spiritually, right? I'm gonna, again, when I do these, sometimes I may have an answer, but I throw them out there for you to think about. So there's the first one. The Lord upholds the righteous. Number two, the Lord knoweth the days of the upright, and their inheritance shall be forever. All right. So number one, the Lord upholds the righteous. Number two, our inheritance shall be forever. Now, I think that has to refer to a spiritual inheritance. Right? Now, that spiritual inheritance may be that we're going to, ultimately we'll inherit the earth. We have to understand that either in a millennial kingdom sense, or we have to understand a new heaven and a new earth. So it may have an earthly connotation, but it's earthly in a future perspective. I think we have to understand this as being basically a heavenly spiritual concept, right? Only thing makes sense, because obviously I don't have an earthly inheritance as far as from a human perspective. I have an earthly inheritance, maybe that I will inherit the earth, but again, that's future from a heavenly concept. Right? So the Lord upholds the righteous. There's promise number one. Our inheritance shall be forever. That's number two. I guess you could say the Lord know the days of the upright. I guess you could say that's a promise, but that's kind of just a statement of fact. God knows everything. All right, but let's go to verse 19. They shall not be ashamed in the evil time, and in the days of famine they shall be satisfied. Oh boy, here we go. Now, what do we do at verse 19? See, I want you to write each promise down, all right? The Lord upholds the righteous, our inheritance will be forever, and we will not be ashamed in the evil time. That's number three. We will not be ashamed in the evil time. Let's look and see how other translations translate that verse. Let's look at it. All right? Let's look at it. Here, I'm going to Psalm 37, verse 19, because I'm interested. Psalm 37, 19. All right. It's translated a number of different ways here. Okay, here we go. Psalm 37, 19. One translation translates it this way. In times of disaster, they will not wither. All right, that seems to kind of the idea that he's going to uphold us. All right, what exactly does that mean? They will not be disgraced in hard times. ESV, they are not put to shame in evil times. Berean Study Bible, in the times of evil, they will not be ashamed. And most of them go with, they will not be ashamed, they will not be ashamed, they will not be ashamed. They will not be disgraced. A couple of translations use the word disgraced. So what is going on here? Here's how one commentary put it. If they fall into adversity, it will not cause them to feel shame. They will know that they're not being punished for evil doing, but that God is trying them and purifying them. All right? So this seems to be a promise here that they will not be ashamed, that when adversity or bad times come, we're not going to feel shame, we're not going to be disgraced, because we know that it's not because we've done something wrong. But what if we've done something wrong? Right? I mean, is this kind of a general principle here? All right? I mean, it's a promise. Right? The Lord knows the day of the upright and their inheritance shall be forever. They shall not be ashamed in evil time. In the evil time. How are we not going to be disgraced? How are we not going to be ashamed? I'm going to argue. Now, we could put this from a heavenly perspective, right? The reason I'm never going to be ashamed or disgraced in an evil time is, even if I fall into sin, who can lay anything at the, who can accuse or lay any charge against God's elect? It's God who justifies. I'm covered in the perfect righteousness of Christ. I may fall in evil time. I may be touched by sin because I'm a sinner. Yes, there's no excuse for it. Yes, I have to deal with it. Yes, I need to repent of it. Yes, I need to confess it. Yes, I can't deny it. But ultimately, anyone can throw all their accusations they want at me. They can accuse. But it's God who justifies, and I'm covered in the perfect righteousness of Christ. So I'm not going to be disgraced or ashamed in my position before God. I think you could possibly move it to a heavenly one, and it makes more sense. Because the way the commentary is implying it is, hey, when bad times come, I guess, you know, no Christian is ever going to find themselves where they'll be disgraced because they're never going to do anything wrong. I've been around too many Christians, and I know myself to know that that's fraudulent. That's not right. All right. And then notice this. And in the days of famine, they shall be satisfied. In the days of famine, they shall be satisfied. This is how a number of the translations handle this. Even in famine, they shall have, in days of famine, they will enjoy plenty. That's how one translation handles it. Even in famine, they will have more than enough. They are not put to shame in evil times. In the days of famine, they have abundance. Berean Study Bible. In the time of evil, they will not be ashamed. In the days of famine, they will be satisfied. So the idea here seems to be a promise that in times of famine, Christians are always going to have more than enough and always going to be satisfied. Well, is that true? Look up how many people starve to death every day in the world. Find out if that's happening in places where there's lots of Christians. And then you have to ask yourself, well, then why are Christians starving to death? Is this a general principle? Is this a promise to Israel? How do we understand this? See, these are questions, because what we can do, the reason we have to ask these questions is people take these promises and they just state them like, hey, if you're a Christian, your needs are always going to be met. Now, is that just a general principle? How do we understand that? Or is it that now I wonder if it goes back to this. Go back to Psalm 37, verse 16, a little, that a righteous man hath is better than the riches of many wicked. I wonder if this is the idea that even in a time of famine, because of our relationship with God, we're going to have some form of contentment and satisfaction. Now, is this a promise that in a time of famine, I'm going to have plenty of food? Or is this the idea that in the time of famine, I'm going to be fulfilled and satisfied? I'm going to have a sense of contentment because of my relationship with God. Paul talked about that he learned to be content in whatever state he found himself, when he had plenty or when he had none. Do we understand it in a spiritual sense? These are questions we have to ask ourselves, all right? I know that typically when people study texts like that, they don't ask these kinds of questions, but that's why we do the Bible study exercises, because we dig in and ask the tough questions, all right? Verse 20, but the wicked shall perish, and the enemies of the Lord shall be as the fat of lambs. They shall consume into smoke, and shall they consume away. The wicked borroweth and payeth not again, but the righteous showeth mercy and give. For such as be blessed of him shall inherit the earth, and they that be cursed of him shall be cut off. Now, there's the promise of inheriting the earth. There's the promise of inheriting the earth. I think that has to be, again, either millennial kingdom concept or new heaven and new earth. It has to have something to do with that. All right. Now, here we go. Verse 23. The steps of a good man are ordered by the Lord, and he delighteth in his way. Now look at verse 24. Though he fall, he shall not be utterly cast down, for the Lord upholdeth him with his hand. That's Psalm 37, 24. Now I think this, now I you can go down and write each one. I know we could go back and try to review each promise, but you get the idea. Go through all of this, find all of these promises. But I think this one gives us some indication that maybe we need to understand some of these promises in almost a spiritual way, right? Hey, God's going to uphold you. How is he going to uphold you? Well, here's a good example. Here's a good example. When you fall, right? Now, remember before, talked about we would never be ashamed, that during wicked times, we would not be ashamed in verse 19. Well, this is why we would never be ashamed or disgraced, because even if we fall, the Lord upholds us with his hand. Now, this can't be the idea that if I'm, you know, walking, like, I can't make this very literal. If I'm walking, I get ready to fall. Okay. He's not going to allow me to get hurt. Well, that's not true of me, because we've all fallen and gotten hurt. I fell off the house when I was little and broke my arm. Okay. So, I mean, I can think of all kinds of situations. I fall down and have seizures and hurt myself in all kinds of different ways. So that obviously that's not what it's referring to. What it means, if I fall in a spiritual sense, he is there to uphold me, because I am justified not based off what I do, but by an imputed righteousness. So he upholds me spiritually. Yes, people may say bad things about me. They may make all kinds of accusations. They may point their finger. They may talk and gossip. But guess what? It's God who justifies, not them. So who can lay the charge against God's elect? It's God who justifies. That seems to make sense right there. Verse 25. Now, this one is very important. Now, how do we interpret this one? I have been young, and now I'm old. This is a psalmist. Remember, we've talked about this. This is a key verse. I have been young, and now I'm old, yet I have not seen the righteous forsaken, nor his seed begging bread. Now, do we read that as a promise, or do we read that simply as an observation that the psalmist has never seen God's children begging bread? Does that mean that that's a promise that you'll never see a Christian ever begging for bread, ever? You'll never see a Christian starving. You got to be very careful about that. Sometimes American Christians love to make those claims, but go to certain parts of the world where there's literally poverty, starvation, they can't find good drinking water, and you'll find some Christians suffering. So do we view this as an observation and not a promise? Very important, right? Verse 26, he is ever merciful and lendeth, and his seed is blessed. depart from evil and do good and dwell forevermore. For the Lord loveth judgment and forsaketh not his saints. They are preserved forever, but the seed of the wicked shall be cut off. Now, there's a promise of being preserved forever. Now, that can't be a promise of being preserved in my physical body forever, because my physical body is going to break down. I'm going to die. That has to be a spiritual preservation, right? The righteous shall inherit the land and dwell therein forever. There's the promise again of dwelling and inheriting the earth. Again, that has to have some, that's a promise. Where are we going to put that promise? The mouth of the righteous speaketh wisdom, and his tongue talketh judgment. The law of his God is in his heart, and none of his steps shall slide. Let's stop right there. Psalm 37, 31. What is it? That's a promise? Is that a promise that none of our steps are ever going to slide? Now, already earlier, we talked about falling. So what does it mean? I'm never going to slide. Never? That has to mean something. That has to somehow be understood my position. And my position before God, I will never slide, because I'm covered in the perfect righteousness of Christ. In life, you're going to slide and fall and make all kinds of mistakes. Many believe this psalm is written by David. David is going to slide and fall big time. Yeah. So is this just how do we understand that? It's just a general principle. Like, how do we understand that? Verse 32, the wicked watcheth the righteous and seeketh to slay him. The Lord will not leave him in the hand nor condemn him when he is judged. Wait on the Lord and keep his way, and he shall exalt thee to inherit the land. When the wicked are cut off, thou shalt see it. I mean, there's a lot of promises in Psalm 37 about inheriting the land or inheriting the earth. That is very interesting that it's mentioned that many times. You may want to go through and find how many times it talks about us inheriting the earth. I have seen the wicked in great power and spreading himself like a green bay tree. Yet he passed away, and lo, he was not. Yea, I sought him, but he could not be found. Mark the perfect man, and behold the upright, for the end of that man is peace. But the transgressors shall be destroyed together. The end of the wicked shall be cut off. But the salvation of the righteous is of the Lord. He is their strength in the time of trouble. And the Lord shall help them and deliver them. He shall deliver them from the wicked and save them, because they trust in him. Now again, do we understand this promise? Is it a promise that God will always deliver us from the wicked? Clearly that's not the case, because many Christians are killed and persecuted. But he delivers us in what way? He may not deliver us here from on earth, right? We may not be delivered from persecution and death here, but that death sends us all ultimately into eternity, where then we get a new body and we have, we live in glory with him. So ultimately he does deliver us. So we have to understand these promises sometimes from a heavenly perspective. So those are a lot of promises. I want you to just go through. You can start in verse 17, Psalm 37, 17. Look at all, write down all the promises and see, do we understand this in a heavenly perspective or an earthly perspective? We understand it in an earthly perspective. How does this make sense? If it's earthly, not now, it's got to be earthly future, then where do you put it? And maybe in some of these cases, we understand these promises basically from a heavenly spiritual perspective, and they're not talking about something here on earth, something that is going to happen for me right now, that I'm never going to slip, I'm never going to fall, that God's going to keep me from all bad things, which is how many Christians handle these kinds of promises. So your job is simple. Identify all the promises in Psalm 37. Right. In fact, you can go all the way back to verse 1 if you want. Go through go from 37, verse 1. Yeah, just do the whole chapter. Identify every promise to the righteous. Right. And then identify, is it a heavenly promise, an earthly promise? Is it a conditional, unconditional, or not applicable? And then how what does it mean? And again, when I say heavenly, in other words, is it fulfilled in heaven, or is it a spiritual promise dealing with my spiritual position before God? So that heavenly, we can just call it heavenly/spiritual, right? I hope that makes sense. This is where you wish the room was full, and then I could look at everyone's faces and like, I don't get what you're talking about, and I could repeat myself 50 times until they figured it out. But I hope that makes sense. This is very, very important because preachers do this stuff all the time from the pulpit. They'll get the Bible and they'll say, God has promised this. And then and you just sit there and you want to look at them going, are you that disconnected with the real world? And then people take those promises, and then after 6 months or a year, 3 years walking with the Lord, they're like, I don't know if this is actually coming to pass. So then they start questioning the truthfulness of Scripture. Don't question the truthfulness of Scripture. Don't question the faithfulness of God. Question the fact that maybe the preaching you heard was given by fallible people who mishandled Scripture and gave you a promise that's not actually a promise, or misapplied the promise. All right. Now, I'm just going to stop. I want to do more like teaching. That was more like trying to just bring you right. I kind of brought you right there and then left you, but I want you to struggle with it. Look, if you've never struggled with these questions before our study on Psalm 37, well, you're very late to the party because you should have been struggling with these issues for a very, very long time. Because there's lots of things that show up in the Bible like this. You're like, wait a minute, is that a promise? Well, how is that a promise? Because look at the world. There's no way that's... So are we mishandling this promise? Are we misunderstanding this promise? Are we misapplying this promise? What are we doing wrong here? So consider those promises there in Psalm 37. And you try to figure out exactly what is going on. All right? If you do the work on this, email me, newsif@yahoo.com. newsif@yahoo.com. Even if you don't like write out all of your work, I would love to get your thoughts on this issue and this problem and how you've seen it present in the churches you've attended and in sermons you've listened to. All right? Because trust me, it's far more prevalent than you think. All right, I'll stop right there. Okay. Everyone have a wonderful evening. A wonderful evening. And hopefully this was beneficial. Gives you something to do, something to work on. So start working on it, thinking it through, and I can't wait to see what you discover. All right, God bless.